say hello. Goodbye.
You can't just make AGM this a delegation of the AG. The officials from the SPOC support got to start. Otherwise, if people don't want to start. I could observe that a number of colleagues have sent their own apologies bearing the weight of the committee. We got lost. We're trying to find the place. Other members have gone with the rugby team to Japan. So this is a busy place, one or the other. And let's appreciate that today we have the AG with the senior office, which is a rare opportunity for us, more so when we have to prepare for the AG in terms of the area that we must visa ourselves for. He has been here when we were invited by Scopa, at the time when Scopa had a similar meeting, but there are specific matters for the committee to worry itself on, and therefore it's very critical that we have some engagement which is going to be focused one way or the other. We are going to be, in terms of the program, we are going to be receiving this input from the AG's office, and thereafter we are going to be engaging as such, and I think we must as well after that, for that. Area which is going to require our eye on. So we need to try to find the road tracking such. Probably agree that let's ask the office of the chair to give us some opportunities. Or if we could afford ourselves time to even engage after hours. Can't find such a free day that did not find free days, then we could as well probably find a way of engagement even after hours on the teaching. That's the only principle that we have to probably deal with. It might be better that we could deal with such. If you have the list of those, now that's one of the areas that I think we need to have a reflection on. Can we then start to introduce ourselves so that we should know who is in the room? I'll start here with my example. Sakumi Sonny, who is the chairperson of the committee.
I'm honorable members, chair. Our guest, I'm Cheryl Sanskalvin, representing the African National Congress.
Thank you, Chair, and everyone.
My name is Connie Sanskalvin, and I'm a member of the AG, the Foreign Committee.
Thank you, Chair. My name
is Mutoko Jokanyana, from the EFF, and a member of the AG.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. I'm Eleanor
Spick.
I'm a member of the committee, and I'm representing the Democratic Alliance.
Good morning, Chairperson and honourable members and colleagues from the AG's office. My name is Naren Singh. I'm a member of this committee, and may I use this opportunity, Chair, to apologise that I'll have to... I've got four meetings today. There's no problem with a Friday meeting from my experience. I think the challenge we're having today is because we didn't have a plenary yesterday. So when we put a submission to the Chair of Chairs, we must take that into account. But I will run to Environmental Affairs where the Minister is and then possibly come back to this meeting. But thank you very much.
Okay. Next. Here.
Yeah.
Press cover there.
When I came late, my name is Boy Mama Wolo, member of the committee of the Whip from the Majority Party.
We have those members today present. The apologies are from Honorable Lezana, Honorable Matafa, and Honorable Kilias. Those are the apologies that we then the whole other interests which are in the meeting. So the AG knows the officials of the meeting with them to ask the community. So for Georgie.
Morning, honorable members. My name is Kimi Makwege.
Good morning, my name is Sakani Madulenke, the Deputy AG.
Good morning, my name is Ode Kabaliso, I'm the Director of the Institute for Guidance, Stakeholder Management.
Good morning, you're from Skopje, Corporate Executive from the General Office.
Mr. Members, I'm the Director of the Sidehat, I'm the Business Executive responsible for legal services in Asia.
Good morning, I'm Ali Okambi. I'm Senior Manager, Governance and Corporate Secretary in the AGSA.
Well, thank you very much for those introductions. We are going to give over to the Office of the AG for the intention of the meeting
is for the AG to take us through pertinent areas which relate to our work, our partnership, our approach, as we are responsible for the AG's functionality, one way or the other. So welcome, AG.
Thank you very much, Chair. And perhaps at the outset, let me welcome your comments and your introductory comments on the matter of interaction with ourselves. We have grown accustomed to the fact that some previously felt that the interactions of the Standing Committee on the AG are probably something like four times a year. That's what they kind of paint the picture in their minds. And we are encouraged that you are recognizing the fact that we have now stepped into a difficult terrain in respect of our mandate, and maybe that calls for the committee to think carefully about how regularly the committee is going to engage with the AG, so that it's not an engagement around the annual report of the plan or any one of those matters that arise at the time, but it also is responsive to some of the pressures and the challenges that the office might face as it goes forward to implement its mandate. For us, Chair, is that we are a big institution with about 3,500 people across the country who, at various stages of the work that we do, encounter difficulties sometimes which are thrown at us by people who prefer that we cannot around to independently check what we do. So, in that context, I think if one looks at some of the stuff that we're going to talk about, it's all laid out in the law. Responsibilities of the Standing Committee on the AG. But when we came here, Chair, let me get into the main part of our presentation today. At any time when the new term of Parliament starts, we are often called up to help the members of the committee to have a better and deeper understanding based on our experiences as an office of what the parameters of our mandate. And in this context, we have created a set of slides, hard copies, which are headed forward induction session. So this will have taken as an induction session. It's an induction session that will also throw at us as we go through the discussion today some specific matters that have already arisen that may require some steps to be taken with regards to some of the So it will be that which says these are the key priorities, these are the areas of the law that requires your attention, but here are also other pressing matters that we are bringing to our attention, which may require your action as committee. So that is today's approach that we're going to take. So we've given you this presentation called Scoring Induction Session, and I think together with the documentation that also another submission that we've made in respect of a specific complaint that was brought to our attention, which I will talk to when I get to the part that deals with the role of the committee in assisting and protecting the AG among us. So those are the two key things that we'll talk from here. But the other one also is the ongoing matter around the present intimidation to our staff. We have not given you any specific documentation around that. It will follow, but we just wanted to navigate the area by giving you feedback on some of the experiences around that issue. I'm sure the members will recall that we often speak about this when it gets reported at a point when there's an incident. But we want to get to a point where the committee is aware of stuff that we have picked up, even though it has not come into the media. But it is important for the committee to know which areas are causing trouble for our officials, so that proactive steps can be taken. Because
none of us want someone to be fatally injured before the trigger situation. Sometimes it helps that we make enough noise before the headlines so that we can make sure that our auditors are properly protected and they know that they can do this work without fear, without favor, and without anyone thinking that they are going to intimidate them without any requisite attention being taken. So that's the long and short of what we're going to cover today, Chair. And I hope that at the end of this session, we would have clarified some of the basic issues pertaining to our mandate. I'm now on page 4 of the slide presentation. Is it okay, Chair, if we use the hard copy one instead of the electronic one? Now, on page. So, Chair, you just picked on page 4, as you can see. The audit office, like other Chapter 9 institutions, has got draws this mandate from section 198, which says we must audit and report, which means any one of the government institutions that are funded from the public purse require the audit office to audit them. So it's not a matter of choice for those institutions. We're not going to them to audit because they've invited us or whether there's been something that went wrong in a particular year, therefore we must come and audit. It is a constitutional injunction that we must audit and report because the basis for this is that when too many people handle finances on behalf of the public, all sorts of things could go wrong. And that's why we audit. So we audit not an indication, but an instruction of the constitution. Hence, we have offices across the whole country with staff that are positioned to handle this particular mandate. Municipalities, provincial departments that are headed by MECs in provinces, as well as national departments and entities. So the whole suite of public institutions are subjected to the scrutiny of the audit office because of this mandate. This mandate was further translated into the Public Audit Act, which then specifies certain specific issues that are an expectation from a Public Audit Act point of view, one of which is Section 20. Section 20 says that after we've done the audit of any one of these publicly funded institutions, we must prepare an audit report that contains an opinion. What is our opinion as an audit office, having evaluated the financial statements, having tested different things that have happened with regards to the handling of finances? So Section 20 further then gives us guidance and says, when you audit and you issue an audit report and you express an opinion, you've got to express this opinion on whether the financial statements presented to you as an audit office, whether they are fair. Now it's important to underline the fair, because the fair presentation means that when everything is taken into account, and considering the fact that as an auditor you did not look at every single transaction, considering the fact that you would have used a risk-based approach to the audit, taking your knowledge as an auditor into account over the years, taking into account your appreciation of the application of accounting standards as are prescribed by National Treasury, as well as other disciplines that are often expected when people handle public money or money on behalf of others, do you as an auditor think that what has been presented is not misleading? That's what fair presentation is about. It's not about these accounts are absolutely correct, I can stand on top of a mountain and say so.
it is fair presentation because it appreciates that the auditor did not see other things. Otherwise, it would take forever if the auditor was asked to look at every single transaction and every single activity. It would be impossible, in fact, because the auditor is not there when people initiate transactions. But it gives a sense of comfort that the auditor is able to canvass a wide area of financial management and be able to reach an opinion even though they have not seen everything. That's what fair presentation is about. So when we say the accounts of this entity are a fair presentation, it means that it is unlikely that there's anything that has been reported or disclosed or accounted for in the books of the entity which a third party looking at those financial statements would be misled by. Hence, we are the interface between management and those that are charged with oversight of the entity, including the people who are interested in how the money is allocated, which is the public. So we come right between the people who are interested in spending this money and those who are interested in the outcome of the activities that were carried out when this money was being used. So we come right in the middle, and in most instances we tell the story as best we understood it, as best we have seen the evidence, as best we have assessed and evaluated the evidence that was put in front of us. So in the totality of it, that's what fair presentation is about. It is the opposite of absolutely correct in the context of an audit of financial statements. Somebody could turn around and say, are these accounts absolutely correct? Our answer is we don't know, because to be able to reach that conclusion, you would have had to see everything. But when we say fair presentation, we are saying that they've complied with the rules that govern how they must handle the money, and we've got evidence to show that transactions that we carried out, including the balances that are being reported on, are indeed what has happened. So that's the third point. The second one is with regards to compliance with applicable legislation. I think we also draw this from the Constitution itself. There's a section in the Constitution, I think it's section 213, which says that any withdrawals from the National Revenue Fund can only be effected if they are as a result of an applicable law that happens. The activities of that particular institution. Take into account, for example, human settlements. They've got a mandate to build houses, and that's why they have an authority to draw from the National Revenue Fund in order to build houses. Same as public works. They've got a mandate for what they do, and the only way money can be transferred to them is because there's an act that governs the activities of public works. Other than that, any direct transfer from the National Revenue Fund is, for example, for situations where the pay of members is accounted for, because members are paid for directly by a direct charge from the National Revenue Fund. Anything else must be in accordance with the legislation that governs it, including the Water Act, Health, all of them. Now, it's interesting that Public Audit Act wants us to also comment on matters of compliance with applicable legislation, but we often limit our reflection on this second bullet on compliance with applicable legislation insofar as financial management is concerned. So here comes compliance with supply chain regulations. Again, that comes from section 216 of the Constitution, which prescribes that there must be a competitive and fair process when it comes to procurement of goods and services. So we tend to pay attention to the particular area, especially when audit, because it is often the case chair and members that if one looks at the total budget of the country, and if you strip out our obligation to pay for past consumption, which is interest, right? And you take the 1.5 trillion basket of expenditure as per the last budget, almost about 200 billion of that is interest, which means we are paying for past consumption debts that we have raised in the past, so put that aside. And then following on that is the pay for all the people who are enrolled in government, right from public works employees to teachers to health workers and all of them, including parliamentarians, judges, and so on. So that portion is the employment cost in government. I don't know what the estimate is. Say, give or take, that could be way close to 700 billion. So instead, what's left of that 1.5 is somewhere around 600-700 billion, which normally goes through procurement process, because governments doesn't run their own factories to produce the things that they need in order to run the systems in the country. They buy from third parties. And the stuff that they buy is the allocations that they have in the budget, if you take into account what's left after you paid employed people, as well as after you pay interest, you've got a huge budget for procurement, which may go closer to 700 billion, just as an estimate. So it's a huge amount of money in any financial year that goes through the financial statements of any one of the entities that we audit. Hence, it is important to be responsive to the requirements of Section 216, which prescribes that when you buy goods and services in the public system, it's got to be done in a way that is competitive, fair, and of course that principle gets translated into specific policies of procurement in departments which guide procurement of goods and services. So that's one of the things that we look at in our audits, to check whether in procuring goods and services have departments responded positively to the expectations of competitiveness, fair procurement, and so on. Because if they don't, it is those instances where people start paying for things they never received. That's when people start paying much more than what they ought to have paid for certain things, because they didn't test the market to assess who provides a better service at a better price compared to the whole host of other people who have also submitted bids. And that's why in our report you will see that we often focus on this area and report on it as part of our report on irregular expenditure. So irregular expenditure will often come from our assessment and detailed interrogation of financial statements where we pursue compliance with applicable legislation on financial management matters. There are other areas that are required to be complied with, for example, timely submission of financial statements and so on. But those are the categories of things that we assess. And then the last one is also the fact that when government money gets dished out to different entities, it is not for competition between departments, you know, it's not given to them so they can be competitive to each other, and the other one says, show me how yours is bigger than mine, kind of, in terms of those resources. But it is more towards achieving certain specific objectives that have been set up front, which are articulated in strategic plans as well as annual. Now, the requirement for us, again, flowing from the public audit, is to report on how these departments have performed against their predetermined objectives. Performed in the sense that they report about it in their annual report, and they need to demonstrate that the stuff that they claim to achieve is indeed consistent with what the predetermined objective was against which the budget was allocated. Because the budget doesn't just come just because you exist. You must submit specific things that you claim you are going to achieve when that money gets spent. So these three things added together make up what is often referred to as a clean audit. When we audit an entity, then we are satisfied that each one of these three bullets does not throw out a significant weakness. Then we arrive at a conclusion that this entity has presented a set of financial statements that are a fair presentation when it comes to the instrument of managing the finance, that the compliance with applicable legislation, there was nothing found that is significant enough to draw attention to their practices, and thirdly, the information that they have presented was found to be useful, to be reliable, and was tested in order to make sure that it cannot easily be manipulated
and someone reporting that I've delivered 1,000 houses when there's only evidence for 500. So that's what is added to what we often report as a field audit. Let me extend the engagement on this matter. When we say that we have issued a clean audit, we are referring to this prevalence, that we as auditors in our independent evaluation of the financial statements of an entity, we find very little to worry about. Now, there's often conversations that flow from the concept of a clean audit, where others argue that if it's a clean audit, it does not necessarily mean it is corruption. We do not know that as auditors, because that's not what we tested. As I was going through this breath, you realize that we were not specifically saying anything about corruption otherwise. So it's normally people who take this conversation further. But what we're saying here is that if it's clean, it means that a lot of work has happened to make sure that the public funds under their care were handled in a way that is credible, in a way that is reliable, in a way where there's also evidence of the things they've done with the money. That's really the extent to which we conclude in our audit. So the conclusion on that speech does not necessarily mean, I think it must be quite clear from our side. But we have some other people that have to debate about what the things that means. But the reality is that ours is a positive confirmation of the things that we've checked, and we are actually saying that it means there is a credible system in place, and the people behind that system do not often take chances and take shortcuts in some instances when they have to deal with the public finances. So that's the, and I'll go through some of the other audit opinions straight away. In the reality of all of this, when this interface happens with the money and the people who handle it, as well as the things that they do, some of them miss the boat completely. And they go straight to entity and they go buy this thing that they wanted, even if it was for millions of rands. And they flout those procurement processes which were prescribed. They can still get the first bullet right, because they would have put the debit where it ought to have gone, and the credit would have gone into the place where it ought to have gone. But the mechanics of going around procuring those things would have been done not in accordance with their prescribed rules. Hence, in those cases, if you look at our audit outcomes, you will find us saying that the accounts are a fair presentation, except for significant deviations in the system of internal control. Which means when we say that, we are drawing attention to the oversight to scrutinize that particular instance, because that is what normally gives rise to irregular expenditure. There's another category of our opinion that we issue when we say that they did not even pass the first bullet. There are so many things that have gone wrong in how they handle their finances at the first instance, let alone the fact that they have not respected the rules of supply chain which they developed themselves. Then we get to a space where we say we qualify them. In English. We've seen many transactions where they try to convince us about this, that, and the other, but we still not have. They are not a fair presentation, they are misleading. Hence, we qualify. There's another category which is an adverse opinion, where we say not only is the problem in the area of management of assets, there are also problems with disclosure of certain transactions. There are problems with the revenue management side. The collection of data has fallen apart. So when it's adverse, it means that there's more than one area where the auditors have got a problem. If you look at the balance sheet of the entity, you'll see that the auditors were not satisfied with a number of these things, which means that these financial statements are so misleading that nobody would ever trust what they say. And then the last category is a disclaimer, where we say that even after they've given us those pieces of information that they were giving to us,
we are not able to express an opinion. Because there are certain things that we asked for in the audit, which were not made available to us. So this gave the opinion that we are not in a position to express an independent opinion because there were limitations in the scope of work that we needed to do, pursuant to any one of these three bullets on that page. So that is the extent to which we navigate the system. And everything that we do, including the reports that we issue, those color codes where there's green, there's yellow, there's purple, there's pink, there's red, that's those three or five different audit conclusions, which meaning is what I've just covered now. So even in our portfolio committees, when we come to brief the portfolio committee or we issue the audit opinions as members of SCOREC, your interest will be triggered by those reports even in your portfolio committees, because you'll be wearing a different hat, but at least you'll have an understanding that the institution that you oversee as SCOREC is engaged or is preoccupied with these key issues when it comes to its report in terms of Section 20 of the Public Audit Act. Section 5 of the Public Audit Act on the same page also provides us a mandate to do discretionary audits, because these other ones on page under Section 20 are mandatory. Hence, Section 186, as you can see, says we must audit. There's no two ways about it. Hence, it is mandatory. And Section 5 deals with the discretionary audits, meaning that we can do special audits under circumstances where we have assessed what is needed. We also can do investigations again after we've done an assessment of them, including performance audits. There was a question yesterday which was raised in the NCOP engagement about the three E's where we assess the economy, the effectiveness, and the efficiency with which programs are implemented and all of that, which is part of what we do. But the dominant part of the work that we do is that which we report on under Section 20. To the extent that municipalities are about 257 audit reports that we issue, in the PFMA cycle, which is a combination of national and provincial departments, that's somewhere around 400 audit reports. So the load of work, including other public entities that we audit, is almost close to 1,000 audit reports in any one financial year, which is a big task. But on top of that, we can do these discretionary audits, including when someone asks us to investigate. We're not compelled to do that investigation. We can choose not to do it if we have carefully assessed, if, for example, we have competences to do it, or if it is not going to conflict with other responsibilities that we have. So we've got the right to turn it down and say we do not think that we are the appropriate institution to do this investigation, because there may be institution B in the public system that is better placed to do that. Hence, these are falling within the discretionary side of this. As far as performance audits, again, we make the choice as to the areas that we're going to focus on. We could focus on a performance audit where we track the delivery, for example, of water infrastructure, where we look at the management of the distribution of pharmaceuticals. We've already done that about 2-3 years ago, where we looked end-to-end on the economy with which these pharmaceuticals are procured in the health system, the efficiency with which they are distributed to places where they need to be used, as well as the effectiveness of those processes in assisting the ultimate objectives in the health sector. So that's what we do, and we normally use a combination of people. For example, if you take the pharmaceuticals one, we normally get these led by people with the appropriate technical training. In our team of performance audit, you'll find a combination of these skills. People with technical knowledge on infrastructure, if we have to chase up on infrastructure projects. If we have to chase up on health, we do have health professionals. If we have to chase up on the delivery of education and other areas in education, for example, the provision of learner materials, the capacity building for those that are on the delivery side of education. So it requires a variety of those kind of skills which we have in our performance audit in order to do this, because this is not a natural environment for accountants. So those are the key areas as far as our audit is concerned, and we have been doing this, and over the last few years, including last year when the amendments were proposed, the attempt was just to strengthen particularly the mandate on the area of performance audit as well as investigations, because it came up in 2007 during the ASMAL review of institutions supporting democracy, and we took steps to make sure that we clarify what this mandate is about in our public audit. So those are some of the things that came with last year's amendment, in addition to the big one where we had an additional area of focus. On page 5, pretty much a summary of what I've just covered. And if I think that if you look at, let's say, the last bullet on page 5, where we say we identify key internal control deficiencies to address, what we don't do is to specifically chase for and identify fraud, because financial statements are not about that. They are about giving assurance on financial statements, reporting on the usefulness and reliability. So all of those things that we do is what is on the green, but sometimes it's always misunderstood what we do, and we try to clarify it on the left, on the right-hand side, that we do not guarantee the completeness and accuracy of all the information, because it will presuppose that we must be there at any time when a particular action is being taken. So that's pretty much to clear the air as far as what exactly do we do and what we do on page 5. Then on page 6, we now go into the area that deals with the role of SCOWEC, this committee, in ensuring accountability by the audit office. There are many ways that we put this chair. But if one looks at section 10 of the PAA, it prescribes that the Auditor General must annually submit to the National Assembly through yourselves. So everything that you are required to submit to the National Assembly, do it through this committee. One of those instruments that we use to drive accountability of the office for what it does is the report on our overall control of the AG's administration, which we do via the annual report. And when we submit the annual report, the financial statements, and the audit report, we are giving you our own performance in respect of those three areas that I spoke about earlier. When we look at other people in respect to those three areas, we also get looked at by our auditors, which auditors are annually approved by SCOWEC, so that us as well can be subjected to the same, if not similar, scrutiny as those that we scrutinize ourselves. So basically, we're just basically repeating what we'll be coming to you on, which I think now is scheduled for somewhere in October. So we'll be coming to you in October with our annual financial statement, audit report, and final report for the year that ended in June 2019. So that's still coming to you. We'll come here and present it. And there are also things that are required. If one looks at page 9, we have an audit committee as well, with key responsibility, like other audit committees, is to satisfy SCOWEC that we as an audit office in carrying out our own activities? Are we carrying them out in an environment that is also properly controlled? So we do get that to be independently reported on by the independent audit committee. And the members of the audit committee are all external to the AG. So anybody here, the auditor general who sits on the audit committee, is there to come and share information. For example, the deputy AG will be in those meetings purely to come and explain whatever it is that ought to be explained as part of our activities. The audit committee as well is responsible for evaluating our financial statements. That which we do to others happens to us as well through this mechanism, so that we can witness anything that we have painted in the annual financial statements and someone feels that it needs to be looked at. The audit committee is that instrument, which is made up of people outside of the office but approved by SCOVEC. So SCOVEC, when it looks at our report, it will look at our report in line with the strategic plan that we issued. Because we issued a strategic plan, which also comes to SCOVEC, where we say these are the areas that we are going to focus on in the next year. And when we report in our annual report, we are sharing with the committee some of those observations and plans that we want to execute. On page 10, like others, Chair, as I said, we are also required to be held accountable. And as I said, that instrument for our own accountability is the strategic plan and the budget of the office. As you appreciate, we are not appropriated funding directly, like other institutions. A lot of other institutions under Chapter 9 get directly funded through an appropriation, whether it happens directly or it happens via another department, but they get appropriated funds for their activities. In our case, even though the Public Audit Act provides for an appropriation, the route that we had pursued over the years was that we must put in place a direct charge arrangement with our auditees. So when we go to them to put our plans for the work that we're going to do, we also have proposed a budget for how much it's going to cost, which means that the money that needs to be used in order to carry the activities of the office will come from those direct invoices. So we invoice the entities that we audit. And that has been an established practice. And the council that we got when we indicted, I think in the, must have been the fourth parliament, we picked up this issue of the funding of the office as part of needing to review it, to check whether there was an appetite to pursue the same model or whether there was any reason for us to consider changing. But the conclusion was that you better keep that option of direct billing. Because when things get tough, as far as the fiscal is concerned, you may not have the person that you might need at the table when decisions are made as to where the resources are going to go. So you might find yourself at the end of the queue when priorities are being decided. So to be on the safe side as well as to limit any possible interference with your natural funding flow, better keep this option. All you have to worry about with it is situations where someone does not pay you, which means that you must follow the collection route. That is better than wondering where in the queue am I going to be when the people at the table have made some decisions and you are not part of what is being discussed and what is being prioritized. So that's where we are as far as the financial side of the independence, if you like, which gives us the opportunity to strengthen our work, Chair. I think we can say here that we have appreciated pursuing this option because It has enabled us to bring on board one of the other very important pillars of strengthening our mandate as an audit office. If I may repeat it, one of them is independence of the office, independence operationally, in the sense that we do not report to the executive on our activities. No, our activities are subject to scrutiny by the executive. It comes straight to Parliament. So operationally, we do not have a problem as far as that one is concerned. And as well as the other one is the financial independence. Are you, of course, it's relative in the sense that there are things that can happen where some institutions don't pay, but at least it's easier to deal with that because we deal with it via a debt management process. But it was very important one also tagged along that concept of independence. As one looks at our mandate, as well as one looks at the obligations that flow from this mandate, one needs to make sure at all times that you've got competent people and competent systems to navigate any environment that you need to navigate when it comes to pursuing an audit. Now, if you've got sufficient financial resources and you've got independence, it's easy to decide that, at least now, in order to strengthen our capacity in performance auditing, we need people with infrastructure experience. So we don't need to go and ask permission whether we can get them, as long as we have put them in our strategy plan and we have engaged in scoring that this is our plan over the next 3 years to beef up the performance audit. And so we've got those resources available and we've often come in positively on our finances, which enables us to continue to assess and to evaluate one of the critical pillars, which is do this work with a level of competence, because there's a huge trust that sits behind the two things that you have, which is independence and competence. If any one of them falls apart, then you are going to lose trust with the people who are relying on the work that you do. So it's a significant balancing act that needs to be always watched to make sure that there are sufficient resources to do that which is necessary in order to attract competences, but at the same time to continue to promote the fact that we do this work with the level of independence required. Now that level of independence required, if you drill it down, you'll find that among other things, the people that you have, you've got to pay them reasonably well so that there's no temptation on their part to try and make up for what they consider to be cheap labor and try and make it up elsewhere, because making it up elsewhere could introduce all sorts of unethical behavior, which means that when we sit here, we can rest assured that there's no other pursuit that we have. We've got professional skills that may be in demand, but we have to subject ourselves to the disciplines of this engagement so that we don't have inappropriate relationships with people that might want to influence how we arrive at these key conclusions that determine whether the state finances are handled. So all of these two things impose a significant obligation to make sure that we are always keeping an eye on what is happening, at least at the level of our professionals. This has assisted us over the years, Chair, to turn around the office from an office that had a very small number of qualified staff in the areas of the 25 years that we've now been going through. And today, I think we can probably say that in total, if you look at the number of chartered accountants in the office compared to those many years ago when it was just a few, perhaps less than 20, we now, at least across the board, have permanent establishment of CAs around 650 or thereabouts of them who are qualified. On top of that, we've also got registered government auditors, people who have gone through the RGA qualification. And the training accountant scheme that has got at any one time about 1,000 people in different levels. Level one, which is the first year, second year, third year. We've also been able to attract information system auditors, people who are able to interrogate the information systems environment, and a series of other professional qualifications. So we rent up, and it comes at a huge investment over time because the ongoing professional development and continuing professional expertise becomes part of what we carry out. And I'm sure you'll see that detail when we present our report as to which areas have we made those investments. Because those investments, Chair, the other reality is that with those skills, you can easily use them if you take your eye off the ball. And I'm sure all of us can appreciate how difficult it would be to rebuild and to try and get back to where we were. So as we go forward and we issue the work that we do, we've also got this responsibility to make sure that at least this work must be done under the auspices of an independent office with requisite professional competences to be able to generate the required trust, even if somebody doesn't believe the conclusion, but at least they believe that the environment in which these matters are being handled can be sustained and can be believed unless something horrible comes out, which all of us may not have been aware of. Now, as it page 7 of the slide presentation, which I'd like to go back to, about the oversight mechanism of the AG, which is the standard quality from the AG, which is this meeting that we have. The first bullet, it's the constitutional requirement that we must account to the National Assembly, and the way that we do it is via this committee. And this committee is established in order to oversee the work of the AG. So that oversight responsibility of this committee will flow through the instruments that we engage you on, one of which is the annual report, and the other one is the strategic plan. Further on in the third bullet, it also says the strategic role of SCOMEC is also to assist and protect the AG. Because I'm sure we all appreciate that the kind of work that we do make people hot on the collar at times. And they continuously get hot under the collar because we surface things that they probably would have preferred should not come to light. And those 3,500 employees of the AG who are going around the country trying to deal with the matters that are pertinent to financial management are often at risk as well. Hence, it is important that we elevate the role of SCOEC as last court in the National Assembly, taking its true mandate from the Constitution to assist and protect the AG. And as I said earlier, I'm going to just pick up one or two situations that will give life to what does it mean, among others, to assist and protect the AG. So that we can ensure our independence, our impartiality, dignity, and effectiveness, as well as to advise the National Assembly on instances where there's a need to do that. So if there are any things, if there's anything that I might just emphasize, Chair, is that the fourth bullet is what we have been preoccupied with for the period of time over the years, which is about interrogating the budgets and the business plans, as well as to oversee the work that comes from the office. And oversee the work excludes having to interrogate us on how we arrived at a particular opinion. It excludes that, because we have been entrusted with that responsibility ourselves to make sure that we can do that which is necessary, so that you are protected from having to inquire about how did you arrive at that conclusion on municipality A. Perhaps it's not required that it must be done by SCOEC, it can be done by others. Which means that anyone can conclude it, but SCOEC will trip over when they have to focus on the key statutory mandate. By the auditees themselves if they are wanting to protect a particular conclusion. So the oversee is about the administration and how we conduct ourselves in carrying out our activities. Now, on page 11, that's where I am now, where we speak about the open-ended accountability reporting requirements. Now I'm going to deal with the PAE amendments better after this last slide, which speaks to some of the reporting requirements. One of them, for example, from now on going into the future. When we deal with the issue of material irregularities that are referred to public bodies for investigation, I think following from the role of SCOEC to support us, some of those reports we will also share with you to say that as part of the amendment legislation where we have referred certain matters to public bodies for investigation, here is our analysis and assessment of them, and here's the progress that has been made by those public bodies to whom we have referred. So that you can assess for yourselves whether we do indeed get the level of support that we ought to be getting, either say from the SIU when we are referring to or if we refer matters to, let's say, the public contractor or any one of those institutions. So that's one of the augmented reporting requirements that we will be bringing forth through our annual report, which we will pick up as a committee. Where there's a remedial action that has been taken for failure to implement AG's recommendations in respect of material irregularities, we'll also share that with you. Say, this is the extent to which we have issued remedial action, and this is the status of those remedial actions. County members are in, there was a remedial action, but they have not acted on it. Or they have substantially acted on it, because if they did, then they have not. They have helped in eliminating the risks that were identified in the audit. As well as if we have issued a certificate of debt for failure to adhere to the remedial action of the region, we also have a report that gives you the status of certificates of debt, when were they issued, what is the amount, who it was issued to, in respect of which entity, and what is the status of recovery of that. Whether or not you're going to recover it, it is the executive authority of that entity that must pursue the recovery of the certificate of debt. Ours will be to give you a status report on any one of those matters. And if you would have a prescribed format in which we're going to report to you, we're just going to figure it out ourselves as to what is the best way to give you feedback on those three elements that have now surfaced as part of these amendments. So that as you go through what we do, we are also assessing whether these amendments that have been made, are they striking at the right place? Are they making a difference? And what is our experience in the audit office in respect of everything connected with our service and now dig a lot more deeper than what we have done before. So we already have on page 12 of this slide some dates that we have provided through to the committee. So where we will look, for example, I think the 11th of October, we're going to be coming back here to share with the committee our annual report. We will pick up a report from the audit committee at the same meeting, but also one of the requirements of the public audit, if we have a surplus based on this past financial year's activities, we also bring the discussion to the committee to see what ought to happen to that surplus. Must it be retained in order to grow A, B, and C, or what must happen to it? So it's part of what the conversation with the committee is going to be about, and we'll bring forth some inputs that will give context to how we propose that surplus to be handled. And then on top of that, 2 weeks later, we'll also be coming back to share with the committee our annual audit directive. The annual audit directive is the instruction that we issue to give clarity to the fact that there are three areas that we canvas as auditors, and it is not detailed in the AG directive, so that it can also inform the private audit firms that do work on our behalf as to what are the scope issues, what scope of work is required to be done in order to be consistent with what is expected of the public audit. So that audit directive is a document that we submit with our strategic plan, which gives you a sense as to what is the focus area of our audit in respect to the overall system for the next financial year. So those will be our interactions, Chair, in October to close the 2019 financial year. And hopefully by the time we engage with the strategic plan and the annual report, you would have activated some of the steps that are required as outcome of that. But also it includes the confirmation of the appointment of the external auditor, because the external auditor is appointed for a period which is confirmed annually by SCORE. So you'll also get feedback on the firm of auditors that does our audit work. Now let me talk about this one, Chair, and it's been our experience over the years that we've got a limited base of private audit firms that are capable of auditing us. Capable in the sense that this work that we deliver, part of it is done on our behalf by private audit firms. We've got a procurement process where we go through an elaborate assessment of how much goes to each firm based on certain information, capacity, geographical presence, and so on. Which means that if they do work on our behalf, then they are disqualified from most of us. Because it is a conflict of interest for them to interrogate our books, but at the same time they start getting some strategic information by interrogating our books. And in fact, they are still going to be servicing us on an arm's length as a supplier. So once you put up your hand and get allocated, then you are no longer eligible for consideration as our statutory auditors. Now, financially speaking, I think many will go the route of doing work on our behalf, because they can end up with lucrative contracts with audit on our behalf, as compared to the limited audit fee that they will get by scrutinizing our books. So they will have to make an economic decision, and none of them have, rather than stick around and wait for an audit fee that may be limited, let's say, to 3 to 4 million from the AG. If I submit a bid, I probably can have an opportunity to do work across the country for 48 million. So any person in business will probably take the latter, rather than limit themselves for a number of years having a fixed income from us as our auditors that might be growing at 5 or 6%, whereas they've got the lucrative grounds where they can actually earn through the contract work. So that is the limitation as far as the ability to attract our own auditor. Because firstly we assess them whether they are doing well for us, and those that don't will probably be your middle to lower level firms. But still, they have to satisfy us that we are adhering to the disciplines at a minimum that are required in the profession for someone to perform an attest function of this nature. So we have succeeded, albeit from a limited base of firms. For example, you won't see the firms that you know. You won't see PwC, EY, Deloitte, and all of those firms, because they are big. They can't limit themselves in terms of where they can go. So that's the first 12 slides that deal with the fundamentals in our environment. And I'm now just going to give you a quick flavor into the public audit amendments. This is a slide. Well, and I'm now on slide number 13. Now, members, if you look at those different categories of audit outcomes that we often issue after we've audited financial statements, we looked at our journey as an office, at least over the past 10 years. This was at the point when we were getting ready to prepare our inputs for SCORE. To say that our motivation also for the need for an amendment to the public audit is driven by concrete examples of how audits have been concluded over the last 10 years. And if you look at the slide on page 14, it tells the story of the last 10 years, national, provincial, and local governments, where these audits are not a permanent feature of the system in which we audit. We have all those financial statements across all three spheres of government. We still sit with a lot of non-compliance, that second bullet. We still sit with a lot of people who haven't figured out the presentation of their financial statements, as well as issues pertaining to non-availability of requisite evidence, as shown here by the red over the period. And often when we come and present these outcomes in the public domain or in Parliament, there's a constant refrain that there's a lack of consequence. Whenever there are deviations from the internal control system, when there are no consequences, people normally do not react to those things and do it differently with a view to improving their health. But alongside that, the levels of irregular expenditure were also getting so high over a period of time, and there was no investigation that was triggered as required in law. And if you look at the big box on the right-hand side on page 14, the red one is the levels of irregular expenditure cumulatively over a number of years that have not been dealt with. Even though the PFMA requires that this irregular expenditure, when it's reported, it's got to be investigated so that certain decisions can be made with regard to whether it will be condoned, whether it will be further pursued, or it will attach certain consequences to someone. So there was clear evidence that these audits were starting to become, shall I say, a useless exercise that says the same thing all the time without anything changing. And the reason being that there was really no consequence. So if one thinks about it, the audit gets done as a prescribed thing, but it's costly if one thinks about the fact that there's lots of people and lots of systems and lots of tools that need to be procured in order for this to work, whether it's IT tools, whether it's physical infrastructure in the form of the buildings that we occupy across the country, whether it's about transporting people from one point to another in order to get to the audit site, whether it's about providing the normal facilities that are required in an office environment, as well as paying the people, training them, providing buffers and all sorts of things. If you add up the basket of expenditure and the budget that we have as an audit office, it's not a small amount. It's already passed in total the revenue generation has probably already passed the 3 billion mark of revenue that we raise as an office with expenditure that is close to that figure. Now that's a huge investment. If you have that investment and you are not able to make a difference in respect to protecting and to make sure that there are no wastages of a significant nature, then you put a huge investment but you are achieving very little with it. And that's one of the things that informed what we pursued in terms of this amendment, to say part of what might help would be to give us this added responsibility so that we can focus on some of the key things that can assist the public purse to prevent certain obvious things like fruitless and wasteful expenditure that never gets addressed, irregular expenditure, and so on. Because the tendency is for people to carry on doing business of the business of government the same way that they've been doing it. So that these auditors will flash these big figures every year, and then they go stand on television, and then they say the same thing, and then people say, ooh, ooh. And it dies after 24 hours. And people go back to their normal activities. And then you wait for another cycle next year, and the same thing happens. So it really just becomes an annoyance, I think, we pick it up also in our engagements with the public domain where people are just getting annoyed with getting to and that's starting to make it our problem now. And then they start saying, but you are doing nothing about it. In the meantime, the Lord doesn't require us to do anything about it. Or there are no expectations for us to go and take somebody out of an institution because we didn't employ them. The people who are supposed to act on them are the ones who exercise oversight over those institutions. But they also have been doing nothing about it. So in order to try and clarify these issues, we pursued this, but here we were demonstrating what is the history associated with these levels of irregular expenditure. And you can see on page 15, when one looks at the history of irregular as well as the history of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, it's been on an upward cycle for both local governments and for national and provincial departments, as you can see depicted on those two graphs. So we thought, Chair, that the effort that we have put into this as an audit office, we're not just limited to the scrutiny of these financial statements in isolation. We also had additional activities, as we see on page 16 on the right, where we say that we engage regularly with all these entities, even outside of the financial debt. We do roadshows to make sure that the outcomes, and I think some of the members who are coming from provinces or in local government would know that we will meet in different fora in different provinces as well as nationally to articulate what is behind the audit outcomes with a view to empowering those charged with oversight to take the steps that are required of them. But still, we need even with those additional efforts, very little was changing. On page 17, we then embarked on a change that comments in November 2016, when we presented the 2016 audit outcomes. The timeline that we have been on page 17 of the slide gives you a sense of how we navigated the journey towards what we now have as the amended public cost act. Significant interactions happened at the level of the National Assembly. Public hearings were held, and we also got the bill adopted in May of 2018 by the National Assembly, and there was further compliance a month later by the NCOP, and the President in November last year assented to the bill, which promulgated the date of 1 April as the commencement date. So when we came in the beginning of this year, we already had an amended that is going to be part of our ongoing responsibilities. Let me just deal with the practice that was amended in the public concept. There is also a slide here, probably it's on page 29.
Apology, do you all have these little booklets? Make a point that you have it.
And I think what will be of interest in those booklets, members, is in page 15 to 19. Page 15 to 19 is the specific amendment that has been made. But let me deal with what is registered, the amendment that has been introduced on the amended public audit. And now on page 29, I flip-flop backwards on this slide just to make sure that I cover the key issues here. On page 29, with everything else that we have amended, which is on the slide before, but the most critical one, Chair, is that when you look at that mandate I was talking about, it was saying, go audit and report per Section 20 of the Public Audit Act. But this amendment that we've had now is saying,
There is something that often happens in financial statements that we haven't really focused on in the system. And that is the extent to which there are indicators of possible abuse of public funds. And that is captured in the concept of a material irregularity in the financial statements. It's defined, and also the definition is in the Act, and that concept of a material irregularity, if I were to say what is it that is so significant in terms of what has been amended, my answer would be it is the introduction of a material irregularity in the audit of financial statements. Because the material irregularity will get you as an auditor to identify instances of non-compliance, to identify instances of contravention of legislation, where it may be motivated by fraudulent considerations, where someone might be involved in theft or a breach of fiduciary duty. There are certain duties that are assigned to other people who must perform them with certain care in order to make sure you protect the public. First, that they probably look away and not burn, and even somebody else with ill intent to walk away with public money. So the introduction of this concept of material irregularity is going to enable the auditors to, through the audit, identify those matters and report on them. Particularly, if those items that have been identified are going to result or are likely to result in a material financial loss. So that's what this concept of a material irregularity is introduction. If you think about it and decode the words that have been used here, because they are used at a level where they need to be appreciated by anybody from whatever angle. But if you decode them and you kind of put them in English, you will discover that this argument says to us as auditors, go look and open those cupboards where you might have some suspicion that there are certain transactions that they may not have voluntarily opened for you. Because hidden in those cupboards will be some millions of transactions and money that other people have used to help themselves or their associates. Let me give an example of one item that we reported on in the local government accounts in June. Here was a municipality with a complete amount of 21.7 minimum expenditure. With the idea that they are going to, as part of their plans, build a sports and recreation facility. Okay, the auditors then look at the books and they vouch the transactions and they look at them and they come to the amount of 21.7 as recorded in the accounting records of the entity. And then they say, let's go and see this sports and recreation facility in terms of where it is, what it has, and what are the facilities that have been bought back on the back of this expenditure of 21.7 million. Surprisingly, the auditors went and arrived at this place and they only saw a fence. This introduction of the material irregularity has been introduced to navigate situations like those. I spoke earlier on about some of the people we have in our performance audit who are infrastructure specialists. Another example, in another province, this layout of road that is supposed to be fixed, and it's clearly determined that this is 5 kilometers of road that was paid for. And so it was tested to check in this visit 5, only to discover that in fact what was actually physically there was about 2 kilometers, not 5. Regardless of the fact that the full expenditure was for the 5. So that's what this introduction of the material irregularity is telling us. which is now started since we have had the commencement date of the public works at the 1st of April. We then decided that it will be difficult to roll out this material irregularity issue across all of them at the same time, because the team still needs to figure out and to navigate how to best sharpen our instruments, because to have something like this, you need to have your instrument much sharper, in the sense that you can't just walk around as an auditor. You've got to have, say, for example, a forensic auditor as part of the team, who will be able to scrutinize upfront some of the things that could potentially fall into this particular definition. So it's something that we've experienced already, because in implementing this 16, and we are now bringing the accounting officer closer to the action, because if you look at the BFMA and the NFMA, the responsibilities of an accounting officer is, so far as issues of finances are concerned, are made very clear in Section 38 of the BFMA, in other sections, as well as in Section 62 to 65 of the NFMA. It says the accounting officer must prevent instances of irregular expenditure. An accounting officer must introduce credible internal controls, must have an internal audit function, must spend the public money in an economically effective and efficient manner, and so all of those things. So it's a huge responsibility for an accounting officer to now be expected, according to that legislation, to say no to certain things. But now this law is not only going to be sent to juniors according to the expectation of that particular agent. They might also be looking up when they say no. So I think for us, we are saying that's where we want to look. We want to look to the accounting officer, because the accounting officer is the final level of accountability in the administration of the finances of the entity. So we've identified material irregularities in terms of the 16 audits that we are canvassing in this cycle, and we've issued a written correspondence to accounting officers to say to the accounting officer that the vision of human settlement rolled out in your area of responsibility in different parts of your province. When you look at what you submitted in the records, certain houses that you said are complete, and we went to see whether they were, we found some of them were not complete. And it's been, or you paid this service provider in advance, this service provider was supposed to carry out certain activities for you, but the other people that they subcontracted were now coming to you as the department to demand their money. But in the meantime, you've already paid that service provider in advance, so that that service provider can cover those subcontracted people. Can you explain this, please? So that's the kind of experience that we've picked up already in some of these. There are instances where there's a procurement of medical equipment in certain parts of the other provinces, where the procurement process was not concluded in accordance with the expected rules that govern supply chain. And we've been engaging the accounting officer to say, we found this possible material irregularity in the audit of the financial statements. Give us a written response to the matters that we've identified. I must say that the level of the accounting officer has been responsible to those matters, taking the required level of accountability, to the extent that where it also surfaced to them for the first time that there were those deficiencies. There are a number of instances also where they have decided to engage the services of the state attorney to recover certain monies that were duplicate payments of claims in other projects that they were running. A normal statutory audit would not have revealed those matters to the extent that the introduction of the material irregularity has. Because this has got a little bit of a bite, in a way, in the sense that if that particular recommendation, once it has been identified and you've done nothing about it as an accounting officer, that recommendation will expire. If we give you 3 months and say, go figure out the recovery of the excess payment that you must have made to that contractor. If you don't, and it expires within a prescribed period, then the recommendation according to the amended act becomes a binding remedial action. And that's why in the initial assessment of what we are seeing coming back, we are starting to see some responsiveness. Of course, it doesn't come cheap. There are also conversations that happen in the process, but ultimately, we think that it can work, because if you give that level of accountability at that level, and you've got credible evidence of what you've interrogated here, and you believe strongly as an auditor that it is likely to give rise to financial loss, all they have to do is to prove otherwise during the course of the audit, so that we can eliminate the possibility for long-winded investigations that happen after 3 years, where somebody might now engage the services of a forensic investigator to go back and try and find something that ought to have been prevented. So this additional responsibility that has now been introduced into the public body test is one, shall I say, subtle attempt to push back the responsibility where it belongs, so that the accounting officer can either right by know that when an audit comes, I need to make sure that the preventative controls that I can rely on in order to fulfill my Section 38 responsibilities have been diligently pursued either through the CFO or through internal audit or through the head of supply, because if nothing of that sort happens, I, as an accounting officer, are going to have to face the wrath that comes with these findings at the end of the audit process. And unfortunately, the last part of what has been amended is the introduction of a certificate of debt, which will be directed to that highest level of accountability in the administration, again, the accounting officer. We haven't got there yet, because the initial steps are to deal with the recommendation. We will see if these recommendations, when they graduate to become remedial action, whether they will be ignored. Because if they are, and the expiry date of the remedial action comes, then we will be in the territory of a certificate of debt, which means that we are now empowered to find this money from you. So that's really the the long and short of that amendment, Chair. And if I go to it means that I'm still understood.
One, we have achieved, and one we have to sustain going forward. So I think members we have to please have a fair understanding of those things. Already we were scrutinizing some municipalities here. The two members of the president, all of them. So when these things come, now they can relate to those angels, to the beauty of this result.
No, thank you, Chair. Let me say that the 16 that we've looked at thus far is the PFMD cycle. Local government has recently submitted, according to requirements of the law, their year end is the 30th of June. They also have 2 months from the balance sheet date to submit their financial statements. So the submission date was the end of August. So our teams are getting ready to go audit in local government. And in each of the 9 provinces that we have selected at least one, you will see that the number of metros in the list that we have selected, as well as local municipalities, where we are going to put these particular amendments into application. Again, in local government, we are doing it on a reasonable number that we can sustain. We have shared the basis for the approach we have adopted when we got our regulations approved earlier this year. So we are on that journey, but we are still going to figure it out inside the office as to, after this, are we going wall to wall, flat out, or are we going to do it also on a scaled up basis? But we'll give the feedback to the committee when we get there. Because, in fact, I'm sure we'll talk about it when we come back in October. Because we've got an annual meeting with our senior managers next week. We're getting feedback on how are they finding the application of this. Because I think we also appreciate that most significant amendments like these, short of them having been completed only within 24 months, is probably a big, a significant achievement, thanks to the committee having taken the lead in driving this in the last week's parliament. But the reality is that people tend to wait much longer, even after they application, the adoption of a new law or amendment, before they get into implementation mode. But let us rush it in so that we can make sure that it is already in the system before time lapses. But what's going to be important from our point of view, and this is perhaps a message to yourselves, that this amendment we've seen tends to lend itself to all sorts of interpretation as to how the future is going to look like. And the one dangerous interpretation is the one that says the AG now has got new powers, so they will affect consequence management. I think let's guard against that as a committee so that we do not labor the project office with responsibilities that are beyond their capacity. Because attaching consequence management is acting against somebody. It is not the role of the AG. The AG's role is to surface sufficient information through these amendments in order for the spotlight to be put into those areas of abuse. It still remains the role of a portfolio committee. It still remains the role of an executive authority. It still remains the role of all those that are charged with oversight to take the step that is required in order to effect consequences. The AG has now got an instrument to get into those areas that were never in the spotlight in the specific level of detail that is required. But on top of that, obviously, there's the provision for a certificate of debt where you've got sufficient evidence to show that you ought to recover this. Because I think as part of what those are the roles of the committee to assist and to support the office is to also assist us in your peer group engagements to articulate exactly what the substantive link to these amendments is, so that they are not understood for what they are not. And I think we'll continue to do that ourselves as we interact with various stakeholders, so that there's no expectation that there will be a big truck in front of a particular institution ready to throw people at the back, driven by people from the AG to some place where they will wear orange overalls. That's not what this amendment is saying. Other people continue to be charged with that responsibility to do that. All we do is to say, here's a transaction with this evidence, with these characteristics, which has led us to the conclusion that there is a material irregularity in the financial statements which needs to be addressed. With this recommendation in this specific time, if you employ it, it becomes binding, and all of us know what the articulation of a binding remedial action was in the Concord judgment. It didn't limit it to the public protector from an interpretation point of view. It canvassed it even broadly for Chapter 9 institutions, because the argument was that what are you trying to achieve when you issue remedial actions and they are not going to be taken further? So, we are operating within the same framework, even ourselves. And there's no doubt that others will be contesting some of these, but at least it starts with the interaction right in the beginning where we issue a written communication on material irregularities with an accounting officer. And we do not accept verbal explanations. We accept written explanations of that transaction, so that if you want, you can tell us it was not you. If it was not, who was supervising that, who was it? And it can also go, Chair, to things like there is a senior home who does not have the minimum competence required. It could be one of those where we say that there's a huge number of transactions that are not properly explained. And we detect, based on our engagement and our assessment of the cause for those accounts not to be properly handled, we could come to a conclusion, I'm just using an example, we could come to a conclusion that the person who has been assigned the role of a chief financial officer to oversee this group development budget does not have the minimum competences required of a CFO. Do something about it. Because to control a big budget like that with multiple activities and multiple projects, for example, in a particular municipality, is going to open up an institution to lucrative opportunities for those that know best how to bring invoices that look credible for activities that may not have happened, because the level of inquiry that the CFO may be in a position to bring forth to those other senior people is at a level below what is required. You may be looking, but you don't see, as an example. So we've got to say you are vulnerable if you think that your responsibilities as an accounting officer are going to be carried out if you still have so-and-so as a CFO. The consequence to correct the situation is to find somebody who has the requisite competence. So the consequence is part of this thing is not just about let's recover money, but let's also take the right step, because you might have put that person in a different time for reasons that have very little to do with the management of control of finance. Maybe this was a person who knew how to deal with issues of supply chain, but financial management and the role of a finance chief financial officer in a big budget environment can be more complex than that. And these are some of the things that we will be looking at terms as well in teaching.
Now, if you look at the examples of material irregularities on page 30, through to page 31, and page 32. And I think, Jay, I'm not going to waste your time on these ones, more than just to say that we've just identified certain irregularities based on the work and the experience of having done this type of issue. But let's look at an issue, for example, a repeat disclaimed opinion. A repeat disclaimed opinion means that the auditors are none the wiser. And the question is, how long are the auditors going to be none the wiser as far as the conclusion on the financial statements is concerned? Now, a disclaimed opinion becomes one of those things that may be referred to an investigative body to say, we have not been getting the information here, and the accounting records are in such a mess that we are not able to even come to a conclusion as an auditor. We need to investigate that environment to check where are these contracts, who is keeping them where, why are they not being made available for purposes of the audit, so that they've rather been able to express an opinion than not to express an opinion. Because if the auditors are not able to express an opinion, and the information has not been made available, somebody in an environment where there are consequences, there are no consequences, is getting away with not being accountable for that which they were supposed to account. Because the disclaimer is not frowned upon in the sense that next year, when you had a disclaimer, you are still there as a CFO, and the year after, and so on. Which means that something is being condoned that is hidden from us to see what it is. So that's why a disclaimer will also be a subject for referral to say you are disclaimed. Let's refer this so that we can find out what is it that you are not making available. Now, the impact of a disclaimer is, as you can see, substantial harm to the auditee,
has oversight and accountability are significantly weakened. Severe for the disclaimer, the impact is that oversight and accountability is significantly impacted in that sense. So those are some of the definitional issues that I wanted to cover for material regularity and the regular expenditure. And on page 31, again, we draw attention to the differences between the two, where irregular expenditure is a contravention of this expenditure, which is not spent in accordance with the applicable legislation, whereas the material irregularity is wider, it canvases a wider area, it's not just focusing on expenditure. It also focuses on those environments where the accounting records are not being kept clean. Hence, in our audits, when people submit, these financial statements tend to attract a lot of adjustments which point to the significant material differences in the accounts that are being followed up. I spoke about the legal obligations of an accounting officer and an accounting authority on page 33 to address an irregularity. And these are requirements of the PFLA, treasury regulations, as well as infraction notes that give clarity to accounting officers and accounting authorities. That's why I believe that prevention of losses is part of the ROI. Instituting formal investigations where there are indicators of fraud is also part of the ROI. Recovering financial losses from an external party is part of the ROI, where the contractor submits duplicate claims for the same thing, which we've already found in some instances, which we are going to be reporting on in the upcoming cycle for the MFA. And then we've given you an example on page 34, Chair, of a process for an irregularity that caused the material financial loss. What process will we follow once we have identified a material irregularity? For example, on page 34, if you look at step number 2, we have already started doing the notifications directly from the audit team to the accounting officer, providing them 20 working days. And we move on the premise that this same accounting officer has been presiding over the activities of this department for the last 12 months. During the process of an audit, we even more reasonable and liberal about the time that we think it will take. If I've been working here for 12 months, what do I need 20 days for? Explain the things that I ought to have been supervising. But I think the regulations were fair enough to say, let's not put them under undue pressure, give them enough time to explain those transactions. So it cannot be a case of we are not fair, we didn't give you time, we did. As well as we need to then assess those responses when they come back. So we're not going to just accept any response where there are significant issues that have been identified. We still have to evaluate them, to assess them, to check whether they address the problem, or is it just poetry? So that's what slide number 34 is about. And then it continues, Chair, to give you a little bit more example of what a material irregularity and the process followed where a material irregularity is identified. And in the next 4 minutes, Chair, we've given you at least in terms of the implementation, I did say that we went the route of selecting based on criteria that we shared with the committee, which criteria is on page 38, how we went about the selection process. You see that we had some criteria that we applied, and that criteria landed us on page 41. The list for the PFLA, all of those 16 have been audited already. We are now in the analysis mode to pick up some of the elements that we will need to report on. Now the MFMA list is now work in progress because the financial statements have been received by far, not all, and we will use the 9 that we've set. Applying provisions, as you see on page 41. lastly, Chair, the role of oversight, and we want to emphasize this and say that with this amendment, it will fall apart if the tone near the top is not aligned to them. I think that's the long and short of the message for what is in page 43. Because we still need to come back to somebody who has got the oversight responsibility and say, they are reporting on these matters, but they are not acting on them. Please bring your oversight heads into the equation. So that's why we say that it was a good amendment to be made, and I think it has attracted a lot of interest in the public domain. But for it to work, it will require the oversight structures and the executive authorities to be active in pursuing progress being achieved on this, because part of it is what's going to assist in slowing down the level of inefficient expenditure as well as material losses. Now, the last thing I wanted to bring is the area of threats and intimidation that has come with a lot of this, even before the initial amendment to the Public Voice Act. On page 46, one has, and I know that members were aware and continue to be aware of the pressure that this has brought into our environment, with threats that we reported on in the previous year, and we give you the detail on page 46 as to what happened where. And we do not want to keep reporting this as if we are reporting irregular expenditure, because there are lies involved here of the people that are employed in the office to carry out our constitutional mandate. The temptation is always to raise voices when an incident has happened. Our view is that as part of assist and protect the AG, there's a lot that can be done proactively. We've analyzed the feedback that we got from our teams to look at the instances as well as those threats as they arose in the environments where they were auditing. And we want to say it would be better if the committee can be in a position to ask those people who have been identifiable from those audits to come here and explain why they think that people who are carrying out a constitutional mandate of this kind deserve the kind of threat and intimidation that is issued to them, so that we don't wait for someone to be injured before we put a stop to it. Because as you can imagine, we've done it in 16 now, so we're going to roll it out over the next while to the rest of the environment. You can imagine just how much some of this is going to start hitting us. And if one looks at the Gauteng example in page 46, anything could have happened in that Ntuli environment. Anything could have happened in the Tebuini environment with regards to the lives of those individuals. And we don't want to get to that point where we suddenly now count bodies of people because they were auditing in order to try and establish that transparency as required by Section 188 of the Constitution. So our specific suggestion as far as this one is concerned, Chair, is that let's pick this thing up, identify those that we know as far as in the different audit sites, and send them an invitation to come and tell us what are they trying to achieve with this, so that some steps can be taken up front. And those that are listening or watching can also see that this is what zero tolerance for this type of thing means, rather than the media statements that in the past we have issued, because people think that there will be other media statements, whereas if they come in front of you as a committee and say that they think, because they are employees, they have the right to threaten and intimidate auditors, then they must come and tell it here, so they don't do it in dark corners and think that those that exercise oversight over us are not what should be want. So the rest of it, Chair, is they meet night reading as far as this life is concerned, but we just want to flag one more thing as far as the issues also of threats and intimidation. We sent you a memorandum that speaks to some entity. We don't even audit them. We, as you know, having this wall-to-wall responsibility as auditors. We also audit the accounts of the National Arts Council. There are some people apparently who are funded by them, by the National Arts Council, called the South African Roadies Association. They also fall in the category, as well as the category of those people that speak as intimidators. But they've made some nasty comments and said that because we didn't make findings for the allegations they were making on NAC, we are now captured and facilitating wrongdoing and all sorts of funny things that they claim we are facilitating because we didn't make findings on their claims and allegations. So if you know something like those, they better come here as well and explain to you what they mean when they say we are captured and are facilitating wrongdoing. Because if you don't get them to come and be accountable for the statement they make, they may allow others to take the same when they didn't get their allegations right. So we just came here to say that it would be a good idea for that invitation to be extended to them as well, so they can come and explain why do they think this institution that is known for something else has got these characteristics that they describe. And we'll be here trying to explain our side of it in terms of our responsibilities. But the data that we submitted to you gives you a good sense of where this is coming from, what it's about. But it's things like these that have a corrosive effect on institutions that have been painstakingly supported and pursued to grow as part of our constitutional architecture over a number of years. And if we leave it on the side and not deal with it and confront those individuals, we might have lost something that is very important, because if they paint this picture and they allow it to become the reality in the minds of their members, it might just cause us significant difficulty as an institution.
Thank you very much, AG. It was rather extensive. I agree with you. We didn't take it in a glass of water. We were just talking before with this information. And the honorable members, that's all the information. You could hear how the depth of things that you are facing are. But if you were listening, as you were, would take notes that page four, when he spoke, page four, he took not less than 25, about 28 minutes. On that page alone, which tells you that the key focal points, even if you have time, just get there on that page. Because section 20 covers the essence of what it is that is being pointed, and as well. The fact that there is no way that any institution of public nature could escape the audit as per the constitution, section 188. So all those are the things which are coming then thereafter. We're trying to expand into that page. And another element of the element of the new amendment, which are related to the effects and the processes that relate to the materiality inequalities and how such have begun, and then the third instance is what would then that attract, which seek to change even the approach of the committee slightly, in addition to what it has been doing. Now we still have to look into the protection of that integrity of the Office of the Auditor General, in terms of areas of safety, of its own independence, because the threat would amount to illicit the threat of a areas of independence. So it begins to put some areas of emphasis in as far as the control report is concerned. And the last area is the area that relates to some sort of examples that they are currently swinging on. And then this memo, which we have to find a way of dealing with, probably after we've asked some questions, which I think there are a number of questions which are members want to pose after such a presentation. So thank you very much, AG, for such a presentation. So members, were itching, wanting to speak, so I will recognize and proceed to speak, and second, third, fourth, fifth. Okay, that's Jesus.
I don't know if there's a process which we should engage on the presentation, but can I discuss randomly? Firstly, I want to tell you there are internal obstacles in the Department of Resources. And what is the role of the internal auditors when especially all the responsibility of the internal auditor? Because I can imagine that they are there to give support to an entity or to a department. At what point do we are they held accountable? And during the previous hearings we had here on local government, there's a lot of support which they get from external or from consultants in particular in most of the department, I mean most of the provinces which came here, municipalities, they were building consultants. And you could see that there's no value for money which was spent on those consulting. And thirdly, the municipal managers and the CFOs, if we say the HOD or the accounting officers, okay, I take it that at the municipal level would be the municipal manager. Why do we allow it to take such a long time for the situation to continue like this as over people are doing overtime? Why do we allow it? Because there was clear report from the Auditor General in some instances which was saying this municipality was a history of corruption. So for it to come that way, it means it has come to a boiling point. It has reached to a level that the auditors or the AGs have got a lot of proof or evidence that there is corruption. And if it takes one financial year to the other, is there no way that we can stop it or leave it in the bud? I don't know if my question is clear on the government.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, AG, for your presentation. It was eye-opening, especially for some of us who are new in this committee. I have four questions, Chair. The first question that I want to ask is, I think, related to my member here. We had municipalities that came, and then they were reporting, they were still on disclaimer, but they had audit firms that were working with those municipalities. So I want to ask from you, AG, that do you perhaps meet with the auditor companies, like all auditor companies, and with those auditing companies that you could see that they're just doing wrong? Is there any way of blacklisting them so that the whole country can know no longer to use such audit companies? The second one is, I just want to ask the AG if there's anything in the legislation that he feels must change to make his job much more better. And if there is, may he please share with us here what does he think can change in the legislation to make the job of the AG much more easier. And then I also just want to find out from the department how many interns are you having in the office. And then on the threat and intimidation, Chair, you know, we can't have a department like the AG's office being threatened in the way that things are happening in this country. Because without them, we'll just turn South Africa to be against us paradise. It will be looting from one end to another end. So, yes, these people who have done what they have done, if they are identifiable, they must come to Parliament and they must tell us what powers do they think they have to think that they can intimidate the office of the AG. And hopefully South African police will be outside to take them after they've explained to us how dare they threaten such an institution. Because threatening the AG is the same as threatening the democracy of South Africa. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Jacobson. First of all, I would like to acknowledge the work that has been done by the AG's team and thank God for the amendments to the Act, because I think it is really giving us hope. And I think what is very fresh in our minds as committee members who attended the public hearings is that at least there is now some form of, there's some mechanism that will allow us not to be exposed, what I think we were exposed to this past week. I looked at the page of your phase in audities, and I would have loved to see more of the municipalities that we have seen this past week to be part of that list. But that is obviously not our decision. My question, Chair, is first of all, in the first instance, when you talk about what the work of the AG, one of the things that you say you don't do is identify fraud. And so I would like to ask, in your management reports, and particular, you know, when it comes to municipalities, that is the background that I have, is that can you use the management reports that you have and the details that you give in those reports to actually then maybe use to identify, incidents of fraud? Then I would like to ask, with your new responsibilities that you were given due to the amendment of the Act, is it not so that now you will require more human resources? Is that something that you have already addressed? Is it something that needs to be done in intervention? I think the issue of the disclaimers, because we've had people with three consecutive disclaimers, I think that will be dealt with the amendments and the new seat that you've been given. But all in all, I think the idea of having then the last one I want to ask, of having the culprit that has launched these threats come in front of the committee, I think between ourselves and the chair, we need maybe to discuss that a bit more, but I think one needs radical action. So I agree with you on this, but I think we need to just discuss it a little bit more. But thank you very much, all in all, for, I think, great work that you're doing.
Who's number four,
Chair?
No, no, she said go first. I will. I'll go now.
Good.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thanks, AG, man. It has been long overdue. As the franchise indicated, that it's an eye-opener for some of us. We are happy and we are here to support you. We have been established under a top parliament, and you need support from us. Also, we need some guidance from you so we can move South Africa forward. So now, my question will be one. I know you spoke about some threats and other things, but did you ever come across a situation where you find people wanting to buy clean audits? I know JFS, especially in the form and other government departments. So I want to know if you're in somewhere. And then please, man, you must be a regular here. Last time you sent you a paper here, and there were a lot of media houses. They wanted to cover you to know what kind of work you're doing. Maybe that Parliament has given you the new power. They've given you team to fight. Because people have been saying, no, this AG is here giving a report, but it does not allow what has happened to those municipalities that have irregularly used public funds and so on. We can see with the public protector that she has power, that she says. She can make people to feel the heat. What you see that on the AG? What the AG that we can help to provide? Thank you very much, Chairman.
Thank you.
That was her.
Thank you, Chairman, the unfortunate advantage of being last. Majority of my questions have been dealt with.
Sorry.
It's fine. I really would like to welcome the presentation that's been made. And it's really an eye-opener, but taking into consideration that we still have baby steps. And I think as we go further, we'll delve into the issue. And maybe we'll have more questions as we start to do the work. So, I don't want it to look, Chairperson, taking into consideration the questions that they are posing and how many questions, that everything is clear. There might arise a lot more questions afterwards, when we start doing our work. So, Chairperson, one of my concerns is when you indicate AG that the buck stops with the accounting officer. We know that they have a contract, fixed-term contract, and at some stage it ends. And I know, for instance, that some of the contracts that will be ending from now on towards the end of the year, November and October, and we haven't received the audit outcome. So what's going to happen, especially in terms of those repeated recommendations not being adhered to, in terms of those accounting officers after they leave office? Is there some way to bring them to book after the contract has ended, seeing that they were there, they were in charge while the offences took place? Then, Chairperson, taking into account the added powers and responsibilities given to this entity or to the AG in terms of the PAA, do you have sufficient resources to perform your duties, taking into consideration you're starting, you are going to start with a few departments and municipalities, but to efficiently and effectively perform your duties, do you have the necessary resources, not only financially and in terms of human resources, but also in terms of security, taking into consideration all the threats that are currently there, and the increment or most definite increment of threats that may come with this your added responsibility. And what would you suggest then should be done to strengthen your work? Then, when looking at you are saying you have enough staff and you are paying them well and what? Can you give us an indication of if your retention strategy is enough to keep your current staff? And you have, for instance, because you can pay people well, you can try and create a conducive environment, but there might be other things. It's not necessarily, it can be seen as unintended consequences that might lead to staff exiting or vacating their position. Then, Chairperson, the AG indicated that in some instances we find that there's no, or the officials, like for instance the CFOs, are not suitably qualified for their position. Then we know that in some instances there are several consecutive adverse and disclaimed opinions. What are you recommending in that instance? Or at which stage are you recommending that those officials should be removed or transferred or taking in elsewhere? And without taking away anything from the mandate and clearly indicating that you don't provide assurance that service delivery has been achieved, we've seen over a couple of years and instances that you find that when we get the report, the audit report, you see that close to 100% of the finances has been used. But then you see that the performance targets reached are continuously very low, so low as 10, 20, or none. Are you not at some stage looking at that and making some necessary interventions in terms of recommendations continuously not being followed? Because I'm afraid, Chairperson, when looking at this area, some departments just ignore it because they know they get a clean audit, they know they get an unqualified audit, but that part, and a lot of money are being spent, and service delivery doesn't reach our people, and that's the biggest concern. So if we can just get some clarification, thank you, Chair.
Okay. Is there anything that you
do? Okay. Chair, I just wanted to find out about the management report. I assume that there is a process where the management and engaging AG in terms of the management report where they're not satisfied or where they feel that there's a clearance on, just to have a discussion and have an understanding. In one of the meetings we had, there was like a difference of opinion expressed in the committee meeting by one of the municipalities. So I wasn't sure why was it happening at that level, because already there should have been that process where the AG's office together with the particular municipality
saw their differences, and I thought that it was not really a proper place for them to raise their satisfaction.
Those are some. Thanks very much, members. Let's start with the internal audit responsibilities. Firstly, an internal auditor is part of the machinery of the entity, which means that the accounting officer needs to budget for an internal audit function. Sometimes in government, internal audit is insourced, which means that there are people who are doing business out there who provide internal audit capabilities which departments buy. In certain instances, there's a shared responsibility where there's a central mechanism for all the entities in that particular region, for example, to be serviced through. Used to be like that in Kaupin, where there was a shared sender that provided that. And others have got their own staff establishment in the department where you've got internal auditors. For an internal audit to be effective, because what it does internally is almost similar in many ways to what an external auditor is meant to do, even though it is not 100% the same. They have to have a program, an internal audit function. Which program must give us as external auditors that there is a sufficient level of scrutiny internally? To the extent that when the reports are issued to the accounting officer, they are acted on. Because an internal auditor will point out those things that will compromise the ability of the department to achieve these objectives. If they don't act and undermine the internal audit, then the internal audit becomes ineffective. And I think for the greatest part, many of the places where we audit, not all, have not been responsive to reports issued by internal audit. And I agree that internal audit is a very important control instrument. If put in place with the right accountabilities, for example, a head of internal audit, if it has to function properly, has got to have a line of reporting, for example, to the chair of the audit committee, who is an external person but charged with oversight responsibilities over the entity. If that doesn't happen, and they report on difficult matters that the accounting officer may not immediately accept, because they are going to throw light into inefficiencies and deficiencies and potential exposure to fraud and all sorts of things, then the person in the internal audit function may have difficulty to operate in that environment. Because I still control the budget, I still decide what scope of work will be acceptable and that type of stuff. So that's part of the problem, I think, which needs to be dealt with. It's partly sometimes structural, in the sense that it is the same group of people who have got so-called higher elevated level of power that I must report about and to. So that's one of the things, I think, which makes the internal audit function not to rise to the occasion. And I'm sure that in quite a number of the state-owned entities as well, if you look at them, there's no shortage of an internal audit function. But they are where they are, many of them, even though they do have an internal audit function. So now we feel that it has had many problems in rising to the occasion, that particular function, because maybe the positioning of it and how it operates, and others are more successful in certain areas. It's just that people don't go
to learn best practices from each other in those cases.
But I think I agree that when these accounts come in front of committees and portfolio committees, that must be a regular question. Where are we spending our money in respect to internal audit function? How effective is it? I'll give an example of a municipality in a particular province some many years ago. I think it was probably about 10, 12 years ago. So we arrived at this municipality and they were handing over their accounts at the end of August. So we happened to be there on the day, and the three people that were members of the audit committee were also present, the CFO and the accounting officer. So they hand out the set of accounts at the meeting, and as you go through the pages of the financial statements, you can see that they were editing these accounts, not auditing them. That the description of these items on the financial statements needed to be corrected because of the spelling check problem. These are financial statements. They are being given to what is supposedly an internal audit function. But all they were doing was to edit them. Not audit, edit them. So in this same account, there was a balance in what was called a miscellaneous account. Now, miscellaneous account is a description of so many different things. It escaped the attention of that internal audit function, the miscellaneous account. It was a big amount, almost 60 million almost, which means that throughout the year, any and every things that they were procuring was being thrown into this miscellaneous account, which you could not immediately establish what it was. But it was a debit. And in the accounts, they were proposing that it must be reflected as a sundry data, which means that somebody out there owns this municipality to the extent of the balance of about 60 million in the accounts. When in fact it was an accumulation of things that they bought, some of them assets, some of them were expenses, and all that needed to be done was for the internal auditor, upon receiving these accounts, to ask the question, who is this or group of people that we owe this money? Can someone reconcile this miscellaneous account so that we can understand that it is owed genuinely to whoever? Only after we insisted that these accounts are not acceptable was the process initiated, even under the watch of the CFO who was present, to clear those items where they ought to have gone in the first place, and only to find out that what was a genuine balance in this account was less than a million. The rest of the items had to be reallocated to where they actually belong. Because there was this person who was the center of this activity, who is the CFO, who did not reconcile the accounts, who did not make sure that all the transactions get posted to the respective places where they ought to have gone. And there was also the so-called internal audit function, whose job was meant to look at what has happened and apply their independent internal audit head to it, rather than editing spell checks on the financial statement. So those are kind of things that we can come to. And I'm not saying that they are prevalent out there, but when you see anything like that, it's shocking. Because if the auditors were not going to have anything to do with it, you would have had on the balance sheet of this entity an amount of 61 million that was meaningless, that was misleading. That could not have resulted in the presentation of this financial statement that you left. Consultants and the support that they provide. A lot of this has got issues of inefficiency. I think that's one of the things we detected also as we look at this. But to just give you a flavor of this, when we look at the total
set of financials that were reported on the municipalities most recently. The total amount that was spent towards third-party service providers was, I think, close to 900 million in total across the board. Now, let's remember that some of it may be genuine support and assistance, but it's huge. If we move from the premise that almost every municipality out there has a finance department of one kind or another. Now, this is spending over and above that financial commitment. But the worst part of it for the consultants is that they arrive in a place where there are no disciplines to keep proper records. And they come in the month that their accounts ought to be produced. They can't create figures without proper documentation either. So they get given a runaround themselves to a point where it becomes too expensive to kind of try and provide this service. Again, looking at it from their point of view, they came in here to come and do business with the municipality, with a view to earning a fee for the services rendered. And when they get given a runaround, the clock doesn't stop. So it becomes an expensive exercise because you're trying someone to help you, but you can't help yourself because you don't have the documentation to give to them so that they can assist you. So that's the other part which comes to this. One municipality, I think in Limpopo, not big, has a finance department, but towards these services was spending somewhere around 12 million in one financial year. Now there's a combination of very wrong decision making. We don't know whether it is an accumulation of the inefficiencies or what, but the reality is that the expenditure on external service providers to support, we think that is a welcome development because some municipalities would better to get some of these things done themselves because they don't have people with a normal requisite training. So they have to go and opt for the engagement that they have with consultants. But the issue is, how do they make sure that effectiveness and efficiency of that service is not compromised, either by them or by somebody else, because they end up paying for it. So they end up with bill that is so expensive that you don't understand what justifies it because the audit opinion is still negative. But the consultant can't be asked to help that situation, especially if they could not find the documentation that would support any adjustment that they are required to make in the books. Because if they make an adjustment, they need to demonstrate why it was necessary for those corrective entries to be processed. If they can't be told or they can't be given comfort by the entity, then it's just a big waste. So there are significant issues of inefficiency when it comes to the engagement of consulting services for support, which sometimes do not justify the expenditure of the customer to get that change. And you can't get that right until you have your own internal people who are going to support that external service provider. Okay, the other question, I think the honorable member was clear that you are asking yourselves about how you allowed this dereliction of duty to carry on regardless. So I'm sure you will probably reflect on that. And then the disclaimers and audit firms, do we meet with them? Audit firms, we do meet with them when it comes to the work that they do on our behalf. But when they go there to go do work for the entity, as I said, they become external service providers and they meet with that entity directly. So sometimes it's not their fault that the entity is not important, because they were just engaged to come and support at the tail end of the process in most cases. So we think that there's also that part which is not done with malicious intent from the side of the audit firm. But the audit firm goes there, it gets stuck, and it can't move. And keeps hoping that things will get better tomorrow, next week, and so on. And then suddenly the person who brought them here is off for a week or whatever it may happen, those type of things.
So the operating environment where the disciplines that are normally associated in having to produce reliable information are not always observed. The interns at the AG, we've got an audit training scheme where we recruit staff into the office. And in most instances, we don't engage interns because we have a very short period of time and the main process does not get any far with us. But we do have other programs which we will share with the members when we come into our annual report as to what we do to expose the organization to people, even those that are not yet taking on our trainee accounting scheme. But we are alert to the fact that in the school program, for example, that we run, which we will share with you through the annual report, we do go out to various schools and so on, where we engage at that level about prospects, opportunities, and interests in the area of the lack of energy. Then the issue of the present implementation, I take the point the members have raised and accept the fact that you might need to also engage further on this. However, I think it remains a matter that we consider to be serious enough not to be ignored. Management reports and fraud identification. When we issue management reports, officially it is an official communication from the auditor to management to bring to the attention of management those deficiencies in internal control that could expose the entity to instances of fraud. It is management's job to address those matters because they are the ones who have got the responsibility to produce financial statements. So when we issue a management report to them, we are alerting them to the fact that they do, for example, they have a balance in the books for assets, but they don't have a fixed asset register. So we will write that in a management report. And the reason we are doing this is that, yes, you've got an amount in the books, but you've got no idea what assets you have. Because the amount in the books could represent 1,000 assets, could represent 50 assets. But how do you know if these assets are still under your control? Some of them are movable assets. Someone can drive off with a tractor that belongs to a particular municipality and go use it for themselves. At what point do you know that you must look for that particular asset because there's no real register or asset register that will guide you as to what are the assets that were signed off versus the amount that is in the books. So the management report is indeed a document that helps management, but it ought to be available to oversight as well, because for oversight to exercise its responsibilities, it needs to know what progress has management made in addressing matters that were brought to their attention through the management report. I often hear that this document is somewhat a confidential document for the eyes of management only. It can't be like that, because oversight is also part of the equation. So they can't. The fact that it is called management report, the management reference to the management report is not about its mind. It's just the name of the report that is issued to that group of people who have got managerial responsibilities over the affairs of the entity. And so, if I am I'm not management, I'm a member of the audit committee, and I want to assess the responsiveness of management to deficiencies that are raised in an audit, the best place for me to look is the management report. So it is used for that purpose, but sometimes people don't want it to be passed on to others because they fear that there are many things that are written in that report which might trump them. Do we need further capacity? The level of capacity that we have identified thus far is really just to position ourselves to support the advent of these amendments. Things like in the past, we never really focused on bringing legal skills or other skills that will help
help us to navigate the areas that we are dealing with. But as far as the teams that are doing the audits, we certainly do not have any idea to multiply them in a significant way. There may be a need, as we go through this, to start identifying incrementally, because we know that the kind of people that do this work, some of them have qualified, some of them are in the process of qualifying, some of them have got many years of experience. When they look at their accounts and they interact with management on various things and they use their past experience, they often get quickly to what the answer should be in respect to the identification of material irregularities. In the sense that the introduction of the material irregularity is an additional enhancement of the audit process. So the audit process is still intact. However, it has now attracted additional areas of consideration. And we believe that with the resources and the skills that we have, we can refocus, redirect, and provide additional support to the same teams, except that in other areas we might need to beef up here and there. And we've already spoken about that matter, that we do not anticipate a huge increase in the numbers, because those people are still planning an audit. It's a question of bringing forward a lot of the things that they normally have to wait and do after they've received the financial statements, and bring forward some of the inquiries that they normally make during the audit, and make those inquiries. And in our approach to this, we've also, over the last 2 years, introduced what we call a status of record review, where we are able to call for the trial balance of the entity at the end of the first, second, or third quarter to assess the status of records of this entity in order to point out to them the areas that might potentially trip them come the time they have to report on the finances. We also rely on that because it will give us some issues earlier than we used to get them in the past. But we know that it will introduce more pressure, but we really don't believe that it will amount to a huge increase in resources. There may be a need for additional resources to provide the central support to all the business units, but I think for what we have in terms of the resources, we'll be able to still get to a conclusion on the financial statements, even where we have examine and scrutinize the area of material irregularities. So the answer to do we have sufficient resources to perform these duties? This is constantly evaluated, but we're not far off from where we need to be with the additional area of responsibility. Because it doesn't say, now that you've been doing an audit, do the audit and finish, and now focus on this. No. It says you are doing an audit, but in the past you've never really had to be diligent about focusing on these matters. Bring them on and use the same risk management tools to determine what is very important and what is significant in order for you to address that particular matter. The disclaimers, will they be dealt with these amendments? As I said, when something is not too clear and a series of disclaimers, meaning that you know the level of accountability and transparency is not observed, either we were looking for a big contract which is already being activated and we haven't had sight of it, because if you don't see it, you won't know what are some of the terms and conditions of this particular contract. It could mean that in addition to the principal contract, there's something else that ought to be paid to a third-party service provider. You want to see what is the basis for it in the contract. If you don't get it, then somebody must go find those contracts and make sure that they are, because payment may still be made against them, but you don't have access to them. So we think that when you get a disclaimer and you are subjected to an investigation to get to produce the documentation, over time it will address it. And I think the disclaimers, if one looks at that 10-year profile, they are starting to come down like this, because there are other agencies like SALGA, among others, for municipalities, that have paid attention to the issue of disclaimers. And other departments like COPDA, who also put targets in there to say, if a particular entity gets a disclaimer, some of the instruments they are using also to support this is to say, you are not going to get additional pay if there's an additional pay that you have. kind of thing. So we hope that with those things, and we've seen that they've started coming down in number. What has increased, which was not there before, was the extent of our outstanding audits, audits that have not been submitted, the ones that are in blue on the page, which means that we have not been able to scrutinize them. And it's a mixed bag. It's not that many don't want to. It's just that many are struggling with things like going concern. And so they are trying to figure out whether they are going to get support from the fiscal. For example, the SAA audit is one of the audits that we do. We have not yet signed off on 2018 audits, nor have we commenced 2019. It's not the right place to be, because the minute you move further into the future, the more we are going to lose institutional knowledge in order to be able to audit an institution like that. So there's that part of it as well, because the reason they haven't submitted the 2017 purely to do with the fact that they could not yet justify their ongoing concern until the fiscal comes to the party. And others, it's just a basic case of they were not prepared, they did not have the requisite information to prepare for the audit, and they are not so there's a mix of that, but certainly the disclaimers are coming down. Bribery. We had an instance, I think it was in Chaldane, that matter was publicly reported, if you recall, I think it was to do with sports and recreation audit in that particular conference, where somebody was keen to make the auditors look the other way. And our people have been drilled in this thing that you, as an auditor and as a chartered accountant, you are subjected to a code of professional conduct. And that code of professional conduct guarantees your continuity as a member and as a practitioner. So the license to operate is also in your hands. You gotta make sure that when there are those kind of overtures, you know that you are not dropping the institution on you, but also yourself. And that kind of counsel gets people to be aware of those subtle suggestions and bring them to us so that we can take the necessary steps. And in this particular instance, that is exactly what happened. They stood their ground and said, no, this is what the conclusion of the audit is. And so we hope that with the advocacy that we do, we cannot guarantee it because we're dealing with humans in this instance. But I think the best protective measure for us is really to make sure that we advocate why it is not in your interest to allow yourself to be bent. But also, on top of that, there are a series of steps that come forth in any environment. When an auditor is the one in the front face, there are others also at the level of our supervisors and people who do independent review of the audit files, who will check certain critical areas to make sure that whatever conclusion is proposed is supportable in respect of evidence. So the internal review processes, including a external party that looks cold at an audit to check if we have reached an appropriate conclusion, are some of the controls that we have in place. But ethics and part of what danger someone can bring to all of us is a constant reminder to many of our staff that you can't venture in that direction, because if you allow it, you will be the first one to suffer. Somewhat, some people remember that they are still 29 years old, they still have another 30 odd years ahead of them, and perhaps they sweated all these years trying to become CAs, and it's in their hands to decide if they wanted to become less relevant for themselves for the rest of their lives. So that's really what you always have to remember in our case, because that code of professional conduct is not for nothing. There's a public interest consideration that comes with the way that we do. We're not doing it for our own account. Others may be too greedy in some instances and accept, but we're going to encounter situations like those because of the internal rigor, but at the same time, be alert that you are endangering yourself by getting to when contract of accounting officers expire. In our regulations, we've developed a mechanism to make sure that when someone goes to NDTP, at the point when we had already been discussing the binding remedial action, that conversation will follow them to NDTP. If we are at that point when we are talking about the binding remedial action, if we have not yet opened that conversation, and the accounting officer would not have been expected to be aware of that material irregularity. That is the only case that will really get them off the hook. Because they did not run away from a conversation about this binding remedial action that arises from the area that they were supervising. They are, but if it was at that point, even if it is not yet concluded, the minute you jump, I think the sentiment of our previous chair when we engage in this matter in Korea, but that for as long as that person is there in South Africa, we find for as long as it was at that point when the binding remedial action was a matter of consideration, because it means that at that point they knew that there were certain accountabilities that they meant to have dealt with, and now they are running away from. Security arrangements. We've done the best we can in regard to this, as far as providing alertness and other instruments that are necessary for people to know that if something confronts them and they assess it to be dangerous, they put a line of conduct, for example, into provincial commissioners across all the provinces, so that if we are in the Northwest and we are auditing, those teams know who to get in touch with should there be some dangerous situations lurking. But there are also other instruments that they themselves as teams have now been given to make sure that if there's a veiled threat or there's something they don't understand, they can quickly press for that which will trigger whatever requires to be activated. And so it is one of those things that we said we'd rather rely on some of these existing public law enforcement institutions in certain cases, but also the level of alertness of our people. Things like there's a product action that it might hit us indirectly. The best thing is to remain off-site and continue with our activities without being at the auditing site. So that's what the security alertness issues are also helping us do, so that we don't walk blindly into a place that could cause such a crisis. So it's a prominent matter that has been raised even by staff, but also we've been using our own efforts with our security staff in the office to make sure that we protect as far as we can. It cannot be foolproof, but we can't have auditors walking around with people carrying a lot of balloons around with them. Auditing is a nightmare. But at least as far as the case is concerned, many understand and they do that which is expected. But also reporting on instances, even if somebody thought that they were joking, it's not a matter to joke about. To walk into an audit room and say, if I had a petrol bomb, I would throw it at all of you, kind of things. You know, you don't take those things like it. So we say, record it. And then at an appropriate time, that person, if they thought this was a joke, will probably get them to be invited. Yeah. I'm not preempting what your decision of that matter is going to be, but it is instances like those, so that people know that this is not just a merry-go-round exercise. It's an important one. And the people on the receiving end of those things that look like they are jokes might just feel threatened by things like those. So that's the extent of our involvement and response to those issues. And then on the other issues pertaining to not just the Bayside but other matters, we will have a very detailed feedback which we will forward in the form of the report, I think, from next week for the engagement that we're going to have on the 11th of October, which is what a section that deals with issues of
viability of the office, where we canvass the things that we do in the human resource space, including in the chapter that deals with values and vision of the organization. So we cover the area of human resources and things that we do to put ourselves in the best position to retain people. So people pass at university with a certificate in the theory of accounting, which is a non-as equivalent, and they come to us and we provide them all sorts of support for them to accelerate their qualification and various other things, including employee wellness, including a number of them, but they are in the annual report. So we'll go through the detail of those when we come back over there from the 11th. At what point do we recommend the removal of the CFO? We have not done that yet, but I think when we roll out this matter of the amendment and we are evaluating some of the root causes, we might end up there. So it's a matter that might arise, because it is a case where internal control has been compromised, money has been lost, and when you do the diagnosis, you probably come to a conclusion that maybe what's needed here is a stronger CFO. So we get to that, I think, when we really get into full mode with the implementation of these amendments. But for now, we haven't really done that. And I think for us, it will remain a recommendation. The people who must take the decision, that's why in our slides we talk about the oversight having to set a strong tone at the top. It's better that if they didn't diagnose this themselves, they take it seriously when it's raised. And then on the issue of performance and as well as service delivery, what we look at in terms of those three areas is the information that they present to us, which claims that they have delivered services. But we believe that the best place where these services can be monitored is largely in the in-year monitoring that is done by portfolio committees in the in-year process. Because strategic plans and business plans of departments are submitted at portfolio committees, it is them who look at these reports coming back on a quarterly basis, who can do the first level of oversight when it comes to those matters. Because they know if in the budget there's a huge amount of $2 billion to spend on a particular program, they are the first ones who will know it. Ours will be to add additional insights in terms of the accuracy of the reporting of that particular delivery of services. Because it will be hard for us to figure out a lot of the stuff pertaining to whether performance in relation to the delivery of services has been done properly. We add a lot more in terms of the reporting on it. But the actual oversight that will happen is probably an instrument that needs to be picked up, as it happens in most instances, by the portfolio committees. Because the foundation also there is that I've been to a number of portfolio committees where this follow-up reports are being given. Sometimes they can mislead you while you are listening to them. Sometimes they can come with nice and flashy pictures and things which can divert your attention from looking at the real stuff that you want to pursue. From an oversight point of view, by the time the presentation is complete, you're not even sure anymore whether this quarterly report that was being presented was in accordance with program A or program B. But I think part of it is about, is the portfolio committee alert enough to make sure that it doesn't get update reports on performance on service delivery that it itself does not accurate. So, but I guess it's a complementary function. We are always also at the audit committees to give our view from an audit point of view, but we don't see anything. Chair, let me leave there. I think I've covered the bulk of the questions that you asked. The application of
the audit. Thank you very much, AG. You have covered the presentation, the questions that have been asked. But the beauty of it all is that you still will come back here. All the matters that you have covered here are going to be seen in the implementation machinery of what you do, of what others do, and thereof, there's a saying in this course, see, the fact that you have had, now you are guilty and charged. So if you do not do certain things that will be told, you are accomplice to the effect. Now the AG is telling us that there are a number of cases, instances, where they will be threatened. And therefore, if we don't do anything about such, we are accomplice to the effect. So something that we must do about it. We are well informed that there is somewhat a sort of a write-up which we must find time to look into and express ourselves in it, and thereof all these kinds of things. So there are no comebacks one way or another. It might be that let's set up a process which I'm going to look into in the coming week. Then I'll advise the committee what steps that I will take as a committee. What I'm thinking about in terms of these cases, we must inform the authorities that there are these things that have happened. What are the correspondence that we sent to them, and they could confirm to us whether they are aware of such or not, or if they are aware. What is that they've done, and you take it from there in terms of what then have a and I think you must someone from the office have the kind of correspondence as early as next week. That will be informed from the kinds of the if we leave them, they'll spread what we have, because this is consequential to the fact that there are a number of things that are not happening in the face of the country. And the last area is the area which somewhat in the point which you must find some form of emphasis, that in overlooking the findings, it as well comes back to the institution which is the important. They're paid for that. They're paid for that. And if you're paid for it, why are you taking care of those outcomes of that process we should be seeing? So we must remain accountable. We should not necessarily on error that we serve in different forms. We must create that emphasis. If you're paid for it, there must be value for such. The value is in taking action which is coming in as an advice from the auditors, and these ours is to set the process and assist the auditor general to have a free flow process in terms of the audit preparation, to have a safety environment, as well to remain independent. We must condemn all forms that express themselves violently, threatening. Of the committee for that support that we indeed stand firm to support the patrimonial function and therefore with so much continue to affirm such processes. Thank you very much, AG. We are going to look into this thing on our meeting. So, Friday meeting, I'm on the development, our meeting taking place on Friday. Even that, we're coming back, we're going to meet again in October, so find a better way of creating these meetings. I said a full house meeting, where our members very important that they are going to come for us in October, so we must be able to agenda 2, thank you so much. Travel safety, colleagues, we give up to get a joy of the head, fun track and strip, thank you very much. Thank you.